Well, I'll get into the topic of our morning together. It is Buddhist practices for working with shame. Buddhist practices and shame. What I did is kind of looked up and kind of landed on trying to figure out what is the Buddhist view of shame? And there's this term hiri, which is the Pali word for shame. There's hiri and otapa. And hiri, from what I see about it, it is really this feeling that keeps you holding the precepts in a certain way. It's a feeling of unpleasantness that is generally wholesome, that keeps you on a moral track. There's otapa, which is this the fear of breaking these moral codes. So it's this feeling in you that wants you to act right. And generally, that's not what my shame shows up as. There is a whole wide range of shame that is based off of just existing, just being in the world that pushes and pulls you in certain ways. So I looked up other definitions of shame, and a painful emotion caused by consciousness of guilt, which that is one definition of it. Yeah, that does happen to me. I do something that causes harm and kind of feel bad about it. That is pretty wholesome to feel that way. But shame doesn't necessarily have to come from some sense of guilt or some sense of making a mistake. We have multi-million dollar industries that are set out and making great deals of money from us not feeling good enough. You know, I'll watch a TV show and, I said that I love Big Brother. And everybody's so pretty on that show. Big Brother's a reality television show where they're supposed to take, like, real people and put them in a house together and they vote each other out. But so they take people that are, like, all these dudes are, like, ripped and they're, like, shaved and all, like, pretty. And I'm like, okay, well, I don't look like that. And then a commercial comes on and goes, okay, well, this is how you look like that. You can look like that. And so there's this whole shame trigger going on about you're not enough, but if you did this, you could be enough. And I see a lot of nodding of the head. I'm sure you've experienced some of this. If you haven't, great. But we have this this whole economic system based off of selling you shit you don't really need and competing. And I don't want to come out as like a ethical, like, you know, that's wrong, or economic system's wrong and incorrect. It's just sometimes shame is an outcome of that. There's a story of Tara Brach we're reading in our Buddhist study group. We're reading Radical Acceptance. And in her book, she talks about how the Dalai Lama came over to America, and there was a council of Western teachers that were asked by the Dalai Lama, what's the main issue that comes up with you and your students? So the Western teachers come together and like, okay, let's find our main issue. What's the one we all agree on? What's the thing that really is the theme of what's going on? And then so they go to the Dalai Lama and say, we got it, self-hatred is the main thing that we have to work with. And so the translator's there trying to translate this to the Dalai Lama, and they're going through something, it takes some minutes, and they're trying to figure it out. And so the Dalai Lama's confused. Like, okay, what's self-hatred? I guess in Tibetan they don't really have a term that translates well. And so he was confused, and what he ended up saying was, well, why would you have self-hatred if you have Buddha nature? Okay, so what I get is the Dalai Lama doesn't understand self-hatred. It is nice to have that motivation, that we have that awakened nature in us, and that is something nice to fall back on. that I can awaken. I can awaken with this shame. I can awaken into this shame. So I can feel that. But I feel like that answer, maybe I need a little bit more. Because, yeah, I know shame. I think it was like 2002, I was playing in this like glam punk band, long hair, really, really skinny, and wore makeup, and I come from a small town in Northwest Florida, and looking like this is a very threatening thing there, and I was at a gas station picking up some cigarettes, and I was walking out, and there's a couple fellows that weren't taking too kindly to me, and they said some derogatory things to me about the way I looked, and so I kind of told them off, and they didn't take too kindly to that, and we went, you know, I was like, all right, I'm getting out of here. So my house was behind this gas station, so I went down an alley, and they followed me and beat the living shit out of me. It was terrible. So looking at that amount of shame that comes with that, that really ultimately, if I say this definition that shame comes from a place of guilt, then I'm going to apply, well, it was wrong of me to look a certain way, it was wrong for me to speak up for myself, it was wrong of me to go to a gas station and pick up cigarettes, you know, and that just piles on more shame. And so what happened after that was I went to groups of friends and I got more shame. That friends of mine were like, well, if I was there, I ought to beat their asses. Okay, great. And then it's like, well, you shouldn't have done that. Why were you telling them off? Okay, thank you. You know, so I'm just in this shame. So the definition really that I like of shame is it's an emotional state that arises when we feel insecurely connected to a group, family, or community, and when it has this tone of I am wrong, I am a mistake, I don't belong is a big one for me. And so that's really the core of what I see shame is. So there may be some guilt connected to it, there may not be some guilt connected to it, but it's ultimately feeling separate from the tribe. I love Josh Korda, Against the Stream teacher, often talks about this tribal aspect of humans, that our basic human survival technique is living in community. We're getting together right now. I'm sure we have some difficulties we want to approach, so we get together in a group and approach those difficulties. And like in other animals, they can dig holes well, climb trees well, fight well. We're not like that. We work together, and that's what has kept humans alive for all these years, is living in community. And so whenever we feel separate from the community, it feels like life or death. It feels like we're being separated from the group. This is how we survive inherently in us as an evolutionary trait, and I feel separate from the group, I feel like I'm going to fucking die. And so when I go to a friend and say, man, these guys beat the living shit out of me, and they are like, well, you're a dumbass. Well, that's what shame turns into. It pushes me away from the group, and it feels terrible. And that gets pushed into my system. There's a Dr. Shelley Uram. I think she did the book Remembering the Wound versus Becoming the Wound. And she talks about this involuntary defense from our fight, flight, freeze responses, that this shame can really come from a place of this very overused word, but I'll use it, trauma. And she defines it as overt and covert trauma. Where I'm talking about the overt trauma, in my instance, is getting attacked, getting beaten. And the covert trauma is the talking with the friends. So we think the trauma, we have these events in our lives where, you know, being attacked, car crashes, death, all these very traumatic situations, but we do have the same process in these covert traumas, being separated from a caregiver. It comes into childhood at times. A parent rejecting us can still be processed as trauma, and we can still hold that. But a group of people that I come to with vulnerability is still processed as trauma. Because I kind of want to cut that down and explain it a little bit, that I don't want to get too heady about this, but I would just, how it works is two parts of the brain that we'll talk about with trauma is we have the hippocampus and we have the amygdala. The hippocampus is a part of the brain that kind of records what's going on and remembers things that you think are important. And usually there's an emotional connection to it. Like, I can't remember what I had for breakfast 2 days ago, but I can remember breaking up with my high school girlfriend, because there was an emotional connection to that, saying, oh, this is kind of important to remember. So when we have something stored there and it has an emotional connection, when the emotions are too high, it gets pushed back into the amygdala. So when we're in that state of overwhelm, it gets to that emergency. So the amygdala holds that fight, flight, freeze response. And at the same time, it doesn't have the context that the hippocampus has. It's more primitive. It's less intellectual. It doesn't have language as context. You following me? Hippocampus has language, context, memories that we think are important. Amygdala is more based off of reactivity, fight, flight, freeze response, not much context and language. And so what we can do with this is feel into it. That you've got to feel it to heal it kind of comes from this. That we feel into the more primitive feelings of, I can say the intellectual story about my friends rejecting me, but really that feeling is what needs to be felt to end the reactivity of this chain. And the reactivity of the shame shows up. Unless we fully know our suffering, we become reactive to our suffering. And this reactivity can get us into very troubling places. And so when we feel something like shame, trauma, and it's unfamiliar and it feels like death, we become reactive and start acting out in ways that are a little bit easier to work with. Could cause more harm, but it feels a little bit easier to us. So we have these masks we wear to mask our shame, mask our pain. And I'll go through a couple of these masks. I'll start with one that I love. Love meaning I fall back on a lot is contempt. I have this feeling of superiority that masks my shame so well. And it isolates me so well, and it separates me, and it's so troublesome that I'm in a facilitator training with Against the Stream, and it gets real in those rooms sometimes. That one question they asked me was, "What's something about you you don't want us to know?" So we get in a room and answer that question, and I answered it saying, "I feel like I'm better than everybody else here." It was true. It was true that we were doing this training, and so we get in the room. We're training to do stuff like this, you know, by opening up, guiding meditations, putting together talks, and the whole time I'm like, all right, I would have done that better. That's what they did wrong. They suck at that. I should be up there doing that. And it's just a mask for my shame. I do this all the fucking time, just separate myself from people. And this way, if I fully know this shame mask, I can deconstruct it a little bit to go, oh, I feel separate from them. I don't feel seen. I want this validation to be like, you're awesome. And it's just like, okay, am I really going to do that, get that validation by giving a better talk and being better than somebody else? Or am I going to have some validation by just leaning into them and being like, yeah, and listening to their talk? And just being like, yeah, good talk. And that's going to meet that shame with that connection of community that we're kind of getting at here. Just that overcompensation of unworthiness, you know? It's tricky. It's tricky. Another one, envy. Envy is another shame mask, and masked with anger. There's envy and jealousy. I kind of want to put these together because sometimes those words are used in the same context. We mix them up and switch them around, but they're ultimately two different things. Envy is somebody has something that I want, some sort of attribute that I want, or some sort of material object that I want, and I'm envious of them. I want that. Where jealousy is that I have something and I'm in fear that they're going to take it away from me. Like in monogamous relationships where somebody can be threatened by another person catching the eye of their partner or something like that. So envy has this trick where it gives this promise that if I had that, I would be happy. I wouldn't, you know, they have it. And there's this idealization of people that person has it all fucking together. I don't have anything. Look at me. I'm just a piece of shit. I'm just not good enough. That guy over there, he has it. And it's that separation to think that person probably feels the same way too. It's amazing we get into a room and say, oh, I don't feel good enough. Other people go, yeah, me too. I get in a room and say, oh, I feel separated and isolated. Yeah, me too. So the more we close off from each other, the more we get these envious thoughts, these idealizations. And the jealousy one, really, I'm going to go into it a little bit more, but there's a big part of that is not having a wide enough support. That we can put a lot of our support, I know I do it, to my wife. Like, I don't need to make friends. I got my wife. We'll go to the movies. We'll watch TV. We like each other. That's cool. I know her. Meeting new friends, you know? And that can be trouble. I'm putting way too much on my wife. And so if somebody can come in and make me feel jealous, be like, oh no, you're taking away my one support away from me. It doesn't necessarily mean a romantic thing, but even like, oh, you know, she can go hang out with her friends instead of me. And it's like, oh, well, who am I going to hang out with? So I need my support too. There's that general idea you need about 5 people that you can trust, that you can go to and rely on. I feel like a great amount of jealousy, at least in my world, is based off of not broadening some of my support a little bit. You know, it's so funny. I have these notes of like, this is what this is: envy, jealousy, idealization. And then I'm like, oh, okay, I read that. I got that. I got that one too. I got that one too. Addiction was a big one for me. Relying on this coping strategy of when I'm in groups of people, I feel very unworthy to speak up and connect eye to eye with people. And if I have a couple drinks, I'll shut up some of that shame and connect with somebody finally. And that's kind of what I was getting you up to talk to one another. Because that barrier, that reluctance, I've been so obedient to that reluctance to just get up and talk to a stranger, and if I have a drink, I can get up and talk to the stranger. But ultimately, that shame is driving that pushback to not talk to somebody openly and honestly that we maybe need to talk to. And I don't know if anybody's in like early recovery here. I know we have a lot of connections to recovery groups. There's a lot of fucking shame connected to that. That is hard. That is, I know, like, first couple years of my recovery were just like, okay, shame, 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 shame. I didn't have the language to know that was shame. You know, when like my mentor, teacher would just call me out on things. You don't listen. And then it was turned into this shame. Oh, I have a listening problem. I don't know how to listen. Ultimately, he needed to say that. I needed to hear, time to shut up, time to listen. And it turned into shame for me. It helped me. And the next time he was talking, I shut up. But it had this bubbling sense of there's something wrong with me too. So when we do focus a little bit on that guilt side of shame, where we kind of have made ethical or moral hurt in life, that we do have where the idea of shame versus guilt, Brené Brown uses this a lot, the idea of I made a mistake versus I am a mistake. So shame does not equate to change. We can try to shame people into acting right. It doesn't work. We can shame ourselves. We think we can hate ourselves into acting better. It doesn't work. So we can take accountability to say, oh, I made a mistake. It builds up some esteem too, you know, that, oh, I made a mistake. I can do something about this. And so there's the I am that's involved in this. So this word I am in Buddhist context is a very tricky thing. We have this concept of anatta, selflessness, non-self, not self sometimes. And it's a very esoteric concept, but I feel like in certain contexts it makes complete sense to me. So we assign a sense of self onto things that are impermanent, shifting, and changing. That I am this body. This body is shifting and changing and moving. I am this this role in life. I have this job. I am the this. And then you lose that job and you're not the this anymore. And so we assign this identity up. That is my car, that is my house, that is my thing, that is my that, this is my life, this is my hair will fall out, this is my body, it will age and die, this is my mind. And so when we have our mental proliferation show up, we self-identify with those too. And so that's why we can sit in meditation and focus on our breath for a while and set that boundary with the mind. And we can notice the mind isn't ours. Your mind just thinks. This body breathes, eyes see, nose smells, ears hear, mind thinks. Simple. The body breathes when we need a breath. The mind thinks when we think we're in danger, we're in a threat, when it wants something. So can we take the self out of that and just go, oh, thought, shame, sadness, grief. Mistake, harm. That happened. I made a mistake. Rather than self-identifying with that thought, saying, I am the mistake. It's tricky stuff, too. It's tricky stuff. So that moment of mindfulness, you're kind of talking about that sound. This is the idea of remembering to come back. Remembering to come back to, we'll beat ourselves up. I'm a mistake, I'm wrong, I'm a fuck-up, I don't belong here. The mind says those things. Can you go, oh, okay, that moment of mindfulness, and go, okay, thank you, and be kind to that. Can't shame ourselves for thinking shameful thoughts. It's just going to lead more shame. So welcome in kindness a little bit to that and be like, oh, yeah. Thank you. Thanks for sharing, mind. Right now I'm experiencing isolation rather than I don't belong here. I like to go to the Southern V out in West Nashville. They have like the best vegan hot chicken biscuits. So I go there occasionally. And when I order at the window, they have to have some way of knowing who's who. So rather than taking names, they asked me, what's your superpower? And I don't know if you've read the stories, but if you meditate enough, you get superpowers. It's in the Pali Canon. It happens. So, and I'm not talking about levitation. That's some parts of that isn't in the Pali Canon. It's kind of fun. But my superpower that I gave them was empathy. Because I've been really on this shame kick. I was like, empathy, definitely, like right away. And not to say that I am the most empathetic person in the world, and I'm, you know, no, but I know this empathy, and it does, it's a superpower. It's amazing. So the way this empathy really works is when somebody's going through something, like back to the example, when I was beaten, and I come at them with this, like, just this terror, this hurt, this anger, this pain, this all of this emotions, I come at them with that in this vulnerable state. And these emotions are contagious. When somebody starts crying, you start crying a little bit. When somebody's pissed, you're like, yeah, you feel a little bit. And they weren't willing to feel that. So they put up a front. Oh, I'm feeling your emotions. It's kind of uncomfortable. Just next time, kick their ass. Problem solved. And so the superpower comes from knowing ourselves. So can I know my own shame? Can I know my own sadness? Can I know my own grief? So much so, when somebody brings up their own sadness, shame, and grief, I can actually feel into it. I go, yeah, I know that one. I know that one. Somebody comes to me and is like, I was beaten on the street. Yeah, I know that one. I know that one. Or I was rejected. Yeah, I know that one. And that's that empathy. That empathy is kind of like you fall into a hole, or somebody falls into a hole. And you're like, okay, well, let me go down in that hole with you to see what this hole is like. It's like, oh man, yeah, this hole is a fucking wreck. It's terrible in here. But ultimately, you have a ladder to get out of the hole. So where sympathy is the idea of somebody falls into the hole, and you're like, yeah, sucks for you. Where this codependence is somebody falls into a hole, and you just jump into the hole without any way out. And you're like, oh man, yeah, this sucks. How do we get out of here? So this empathy is having this way to get into the hole with them and have a lifeline, to be grounded. And I really think that this practice is the way to ground ourselves in support of others being able to say what they need to say, feel into what they say, but still have that breath, body, sound. All those things available to us to hold it into a sturdy space for them to share openly and honestly. And when I talk about this empathy, it isn't necessarily a comparison to that. There's this idea of suffering comparison that gets really tricky. That I say, oh man, I was really beaten. You know, some of these guys really did a number on me. And then somebody's like, oh yeah, I've had my fucking nose broken, ribs broken. Yeah. It's yeah. You know, it's that. That's like no big deal. A lot of times that happens when, okay, I'm suffering financially. I'm having a lot of problems financially right now, and it's really getting to me. Well, you're not in a third world country, get over it. And it's that suffering comparison that totally invalidates the experience you're going through. It happened to me definitely early in my Dharma practice that I sat with a lot of veterans, a lot of war veterans. My own teacher was a Vietnam veteran. Friends of mine were in Afghanistan, missing limbs. And these big elaborate stories. So I would talk to my teacher about my story, and it's like, but you know, you've been to Vietnam. And what he says to me is, everybody has their Vietnam. It's not this comparison. No big deal, get over it. I've been to Vietnam, I've killed people. It's like, yeah, you have your suffering, and I have my suffering. It's loud. And so, ultimately, what kind of disassembles or allows us to be with this shame a little bit. Is this connection? That empathy is connection. I know. I love saying that love is just a synonym for connection. Can I love myself, connect with myself as I am in the fullness of my experience, not just the parts of me that I think are pretty and wonderful, the dark parts that I really am kind of ashamed of. Can I connect with the fullness of that experience directly so I can connect with others in their fullness of experience directly? And so while we're doing this personal work, it's a very noble path. It's a very generous path to do this because the world out there is very isolating. We have a lot of people in this town, but I've never felt so isolated. So ultimately, what we can meet that isolation with is connection. And we get together in these groups. Basic survival technique, and the Buddha kind of, or not more than kind of, definitely emphasized this community aspect of the practice. Sangha is the word we use here. That we tend to think of monks going off into the Himalayas, into the cave, and never coming out. Sure, they would do that. They would go into the cave, meditate, but then they would come back into communities. There's a story that I'm sure some of you have heard over and over again. You're going to hear it again. For those of you who haven't heard it, very emphasized story that the Buddha's assistant, a younger guy, is his cousin named Ananda, and he comes to the Buddha with an insight. Oh, I got it. That half of the practice is community, is Sangha. And the Buddha so eloquently says, Not so, Ananda. Sangha is the whole of the practice. This community is the whole of the practice. So we think we can, isolate ourselves. I sit at home. I sit at home a lot. It's important to have a home practice for me. And at the same time, it is very important to come to places like this and have groups of people that I can lean on and talk to. It's important. Well, sometimes we'll go into these meditation centers and we'll listen to the person on stage and never talk to each other. This is what's important. All of you are important in this. It isn't just, listen to the guy who's done it a lot. No, listen to one another. You're all experts at your own experience. So lean into that. And there's also things like envy and jealousy, especially envy. The one I experience a lot is this. The way we can meet that is this practice called mudita. Mudita is sympathetic joy or appreciative joy. It's this aspect of joy, of leaning into others' joy. When somebody has something, we may develop a scarcity mentality that there's not enough to go around. Somebody can get a new job. Where's my new job? And lean into that and be like, good for them. I'm glad they got that job. It's good for them. And lean into that. And there's this idea that if you can only find joy in your own experience, you're cutting your opportunity for joy from 7 billion to 1. And we can find joy in so many other people's successes. And that cultivates in us. We feel that. I go on these against this stream retreats occasionally, and years ago, not too many years ago, but I went on this against the stream retreat out in Joshua Tree, and it was really nice. I look up and there's like tattooed, relatively young people there, West Coasters, Southern California punk rockers there, and I was like, oh cool, we're sitting in meditation, but every day, in the middle of the day, they did this five rhythms thing, this dancing. And I was like, I did it once, and I'm like, okay, cool, we're dancing at a meditation retreat. And then I was like, okay, fuck this. And then I did it like once or twice and then just didn't show up for the rest of it. And then that shame showed up. that's not belonging. What? Why the hell are we dancing on a meditation retreat? And then, like, how are they getting so much out of it? I'm getting nothing out of it. Like, they're having so much fun. That's so phony. And then it's just like, oh, this mudita showed up. And so I started practicing this appreciative joy, looking at other people dancing, breaking down. They were crying during this dancing. Totally didn't get it. But, and at the same time, I'm grateful that they're getting something out of it. So leaning into their progress with that. And so I had a lot of breakthrough and insight with this mudita. And then a year later, I went to the same retreat. And there was this young hippie girl there that she put a crystal in front of the room. I'm sure that works for somebody. I don't understand it. And then during the break of the walking meditation, where I'm taking my walking very seriously, I look up and she's out in the desert doing this yoga dance stuff. And I'm like, oh, fucking, what is up with her? You know, this judgment of, like, you're doing this retreat totally wrong. Yeah? Like, look at me. I'm, like, walking, like, back and forth over and over again. You're dancing and shit and doing yoga. And then, so this was early on the retreat. The rest of the retreat, all I did, shot mudita towards her. And so I would sit in the meditation hall. There's a lot of people at these retreats, like 100 people at this retreat. So I'm sitting there in the meditation hall and sitting. And then somebody rings the bell and people leave. But I'm still sitting there because I'm really feeling this joy for this girl. And just with my eyes closed, sitting. And then I look over and she's like right over there sitting. Two. So it's just two of us in the room. I'm just shooting this joy at her. I'm like, okay, she's still there. And at the end of the retreat, we broke silence. And she came up to me and she gave me a piece of her crystal. Which I was really nice. And by that time, I had all this joy for her. And then she said, you were such a motivation for me. Because this is my first retreat. And you were so dedicated. So anytime they rang the bell, everybody left, but you're just still sitting there. I said, well, I was sitting there because you were still sitting there. I said, I was shooting joy at you. You're my object of mudita, this whole retreat. And we had this like beautiful moment of like this bitter tattooed guy and this young, delightful hippie. We're just like, yeah, we really like felt each other. And it was really beautiful and wonderful and softened me up some. I don't have aversion to crystals anymore. Now they remind me of this young hippie girl. So that's nice. But yeah, I want to end it there and leave a couple minutes for some sharing. So thank you for listening.